Just for the tape, this is September the 1st, 1981, and we're speaking with David Motlow of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. He's the Cultural Heritage Director for the tribe. David, something that people are very interested in knowing, they're a little confused about, just what is the Seminole Tribe of Florida?
I believe it's a group of people in Florida that has a great deal of knowledge of what freedom really is. I think during the Seminole Wars and the big battles that they had, Seminoles were the only ones in the United States never signed a peace treaty, so they're the original, I guess, freedom lovers, I think, of the United States. And I think that this is something that we hold dearly, and I think that it's very much part of our lives, I think, here in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Where originally did the Seminoles come from before they were in Florida?
Okay, there were some tribes from Georgia and Alabama, Mississippi, around those areas, and some in northern Florida. As the white settlers settled in around those areas, they started moving south, and there's a lot of mixed tribes within, I guess, Florida, and we just happened to be an offspring of some of them, and also some of the Clusa Indians that were living in Florida. And I think we kind of intermixed with them, so we're a mixture of various tribes, mm-hmm. and so we have a whole, I guess, whole world of people here.
Mm-hmm. Do you think at all that the cultural heritage of the Seminoles is in danger of dying?
I don't believe so. I don't believe they're in any type of danger. I think that one of the things that we've learned since we started this program is that a lot of the people are aware of their history as compared to being aware of their own American history. I guess the history of the Revolution and all this. They're less informed in those areas than they are with their own culture. They're very aware of that.
How long has the cultural program been going?
It's only been for 2 years right now. Basically, it started off as a little outreach program. I was working with a drug abuse program, and one of the things that I found out was that talking to a lot of these young adults that were in some type of, I guess, problems with drugs or alcohol, was that they weren't very aware of who they were. And it started then that some of them would be interested in learning. And this is how it started and it evolved into a cultural heritage program.
I think that's wonderful. Do you think that by learning the cultural heritage, it helped in the therapy sessions with drug abuse and alcohol abuse?
I think it does, because the Indian people are very vulnerable, I think, to alcohol and drugs, because they've never been really acquainted to it. I think the Europeans who's dealt with alcohol and drugs, they're accustomed to it long before the Indians were in the United States. So the Indians are very vulnerable to, I think, a lot of outside things coming into the reservations. I think even ideas, I think that's one of the reasons that the young people get into them, because is that they don't have a wide range of understanding within their own culture. So they're real vulnerable to get into a lot of these areas.
I think that's very true. I know that one of the main, one of the most important parts of Seminole culture is the green corn ceremony. Is this still something that's important in the tribe? Do people still go ahead and do the green corn dance and have the ceremonies? Or what's happened with that, or what is it?
It's a social outing that's held, I think, highly within any community, I think any reservation. This is a time when all the, I guess, the communities from different reservations get together. Right now, the traditional people that are holding those things annually are the Miccosukees. These are the ones located on Tim Mama Trail. And any time you have one of these gatherings, you get quite a few people coming from different reservations to attend. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the, I guess, main events within the Seminole people's lives.
Mm-hmm. When is it held?
I'm sorry, I haven't. I've never went to one, but it's I think it's around March.
Yeah. Uh huh. You mentioned that the Miccosukees were holding it. What's the difference between the Miccosukee tribe and the Seminole tribe?
Well, the Seminole is a name that the Seminole name itself, the description. That's what it is, really. It's just not a name, but it's a description of a people. Within our language, it would mean the wild ones, Seminole. That's what the English interpreted into Seminole. Mm-hmm. But and then the Miccosukee tribe, they're going by their name, their description.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about in your cultural heritage program? What are some of the things that you teach the young people? Do you teach them, for instance, are there any legends?
Yes, we do. We teach them quite a bit of legends. Stories that are handed down from generation to generation. During, I guess, the 2 years that we worked with our people, this gave us an opportunity to kind of put them on a little pedestal where you can spin it around and look at it and observe. One of the things that we learned is that the language isn't written, but then this communication between the elders and the young people is one of the reasons that we have retained our language. Another thing is that this relationship between the old and the young is pretty close. This is the binding area because of the history that has to be told by them. I think the outside world could benefit quite a bit from this because instead of putting them in, I think, retirement homes, we put these people back to work with the younger kids by teaching them stories or showing them handicraft. At one point, we've already started. This is the making of the traditional dugout. We're taking the kids and taking them out in the woods, show them how it was done. And one of the main individuals that are working with us, his name is Frank Charlie. Mm-hmm. He's a real elderly man. And one of the things that he states is, when you decide to build a dugout, your whole mental process, it's in your head of how you want to build it. Then this process is preceded by cutting the tree down. And once this whole process starts, you never stop. And I think that's a good indication that once you start something, you complete it. And these are some of the kids. The kids are being aware of what's being done. And so this process, they'll follow it until it gets completed. And I think that a lot of times we ourselves sometimes get into a habit where we start certain things, but we never finish it. And I think this is a pretty good, I guess, little lesson you can learn from this.
And Frank Charlie is one of the men who knows how to still knows how to do a dugout canoe from start to finish.
Yes, he is. He's about 85 years old or 86 years old, and this is one of his. A lot of people are I guess within the Indian culture, a lot of different people play a different part within the society. They work the canoe builders, the farmers, and the hunters, and the warriors, and he just happened to be one of the canoe builders, and. Then there's the medicine takers and caretakers, and so everybody plays a certain part within the community, and he's one of the individuals that build canoes, so he's pretty knowledgeable how to build these things.
That's wonderful that that's not going to, you know, die with some of the older individuals. Do you think, then, that the family, the extended family, is important in Seminole culture, the old people being in close with the young people?
Yeah, I think it is because... like I said, being able to isolate the Indian people from the outside world, as we're doing with the Cultural Heritage Program, we put all our energy back into our own people, and we start, I guess, dissecting the whole system of the Indian culture, the clan system, the family system, and look back at them pretty thoroughly, and we see that everybody played a part within everybody's lives. And in that case, there was a lot of relationship or close ties to one another, and I think that's what made the stronger family. I think, and I think when non-Indians came into this country, I think the wilderness, or the hard life, bonded people pretty close together. With us, it's the family system. With you, maybe it was out of fear or something, but there's always been a bond when people are pretty strong. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same way. I think in this country, I think. You get all the people from different states to put them all in a certain area. You'll find certain ingredient in that people that they'll bond all those people together, no matter what language they're speaking. And I think that this is what we're looking for here. And I think when you get this bonding process rolling, then everybody's concerned for one another. Then you start eliminating, I guess, the alcohol and the drug abuse and whatever substance that might, you know, harm other people. I think this is what you get.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's maybe a new pride in the younger members of the tribe now because of learning about cultural heritage?
I think there is. I think that a lot of the young people are pretty aware of, I think, the responsibility they have to the outside world, not only to themselves, but it's like there's minds within the tribe that haven't started working yet. Once these get into gear, I think there'll be new technology coming out of Indian people, not just here in Florida, but I think throughout the United States. I see a lot of pride coming back, because Indians always have been proud people. One of the things that I found out is that the Indian people have always either volunteered or went to war, I guess, during World War I, II, and yeah. Korea, and Vietnam. It's just then we start looking at a larger scale, all the other Indian people, and we find a lot of their tribal members have went to war defending their country. So there's a lot of, outlook on what I guess the United States is all about, and it's just parts of it. So we're seeing it.
Well, that's wonderful. Can you tell me who was Josie Billy?
He was one of our oldest medicine men. He passed away not too long ago. And dealing with cultural heritage, I had a chance to meet with him. And he did have a lot of knowledge of the medicine. I think of the past. He was pretty accurate with his histories too. Mm-hmm. Going back over and meeting with some of the people who participated within our history making, a lot of histories are written about him, some aren't written about him. We start, I guess, going over it, and we start seeing that a lot of things that he told us were pretty accurate within the history books. So he was a pretty knowledgeable man.
Mm-hmm. And he just kept this alive in his head.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
Is anyone carrying on his work now?
Yes. One of the things that I guess that I get inspired by certain things that happen within our tribe, mm-hmm. and lets me know that the tribe is really moving in the right direction, is that on his deathbed, one of his students who had been working with him, learning how to make medicine, treated him and prolonged his life as he was laying on his, his deathbed. And that was the indication that the process has been recycled again. Once mm-hmm. this gentleman left off, there was another person to come and take his place. And I think that then we're getting back to the Indian culture, how binding it is, that once somebody leaves, then somebody takes over again. Then this whole process continues. And I think even with that canoe making, I think somebody will pick that up and continue with that. So I don't think our culture is dying out. I think that's a pretty good indication right there that the cycle is still being carried on.
Mm-hmm. How does one get to be a medicine man?
A long time. it's a long process. The reason I got into it is because my grandfather and his grandfather, the whole generation on my father's side, have always been medicine men. And it's the same way on my mother's side. So I was, you know, had to come down sooner or later. But it's a process that takes a great deal of time. Right now I'm just becoming aware of it, but on a very small scale. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of our parents or grandparents who were medicine men started at a very young age, by the age of 4 or 5, once they start speaking their own language. Their parents took them out in the woods. First thing they did, they started explaining what herbs were, what kind of herbs for what kind of diseases. And these steps were taken over a long period of time. And some of them didn't start practice until they were about 60 years old. Mm-hmm. So it takes a great deal of time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad that it's still going on. I know Frank Shore, is he still practicing?
Yeah.
Which is good. Yeah, one of the older ones. Who was your father and grandfather?
My grandfather's name was John Motlow. Mm-hmm. And he died not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the, he was considered one of the stronger medicine men because of his family background. Another thing about medicine men is that when we have a chance to sit down and start looking at certain, I guess, degrees of medicines that these people carry, we start seeing that also some people start specializing in certain areas. Maybe some people have, maybe they can cure a certain disease within a certain body. Then they'll treat those people. As to other people, they'll specialize in other areas too. So even then, we have specialists no matter where you go, I guess. But they're pretty interesting in that area. Uh-huh.
But it does take a long time to learn those kinds of things.
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah.
Now, I think another thing is that when we start talking about medicine men, there's a sense that these people, they go out in the woods and gather herbs and you know, snakes and lizards and all this, but it's not so. I think in the movies, they've always isolated this medicine man. They made him put a headdress on with horns or something, and he stood off in a corner, and everybody was scared of him. But the medicine men that I have known were pretty close to the community, pretty close to the people, because if he wasn't that close to them, he wouldn't be caring for them. And this gentleman, he cared a lot for him, because you can get him up at any hours of the day, and he'd get up and perform medicines for certain people. And it's still being practiced today. And that's one of the first things I tell you, is that you are concerned about your people, and you do these things. And I think that even a lot of Indian people, or younger kids, still visualize medicine men differently. And it was funny. I think a couple of weeks ago, me and my son we have one of these elderly gentlemen that come visit us all the time. He's a medicine man. His name is Buffalo Jim. Mm-hmm. And he came over and he was talking to me for a little while, and he left. My son came over and he says, you know, what do you want? I just told him he was visiting. He said, he stood there for a while. I says, yeah, I've seen him out there for a long time, and he finally came over. I asked him what he was doing. He said he was out there picking up herbs. And you know, that's history in the making right there, that this gentleman is still performing the task that he was asked to do, and the younger kids are seeing him, and then a lot of other kids don't know that it even exists, you know. So I think we're pretty gifted in those areas, that we can see a lot of these things still going on.
Right. Would the medicine man and the tribe, are they also spiritual leaders for the people, as well as healing physical ailments?
Yes, they are, because in talking to a medicine man, he doesn't heal just a body part. He heals a mm-hmm. spiritual part. There's three parts to a human body, and this is what they'll explain to you. And the three parts are the mind, the body, the spirit. It's like a triangle, and every one of them fits into one another. And you can't heal one without healing the others. If an individual has a certain mental problem or mental, I guess, flaws in his area, then he'll sit down with them and talk to these people and try to get them back on the right process of thinking. He's a psychologist or anything you can think of that he plays a part in. He's a counselor, he's a doctor, and he plays a whole person. And what he tries to do is like a puzzle that's falling apart, and he has to refit him correctly. And he takes a lot of time and care to do that. And I think that this is what he's all about, is one of the backbone within the Indian tribe, I think throughout the United States there are.
That's really interesting, because Western medicine, you know, our medicine has always kind of looked at the body as separate from the mind, and now they're coming around full circle and realizing that you can't treat one without the other, and that your mind has, you know, they've been treating people with slowing down their heart rate and their blood pressure, and they found out that that's really true. The mind is, and your spirit are so tied into it that you can't heal one without the other, like you said.
Yeah.
I was wondering, too, you happened to mention that there are different clans within the Seminole tribe. How many different clans?
I think there's about 12 of them. Uh-huh. And I think these clans are the families. Uh-huh. And these families are throughout the United States, because my wife, she's a Bear Clan, and I can go up north and visit them and tell my wife the Bear Clan. And they want to meet her because she's part of that family. I think this is one of the things that keeps these ties together, I think, not only within our tribe, but also with the other tribes. And I think that... I think it's just like we haven't gotten in, I guess, that far yet into developing the Indian culture yet, but I think these are some of the tools that we'll use eventually to, I guess, build our own United Nations, that there are certain, I think, certain areas that people unite to, and these are the clan system. I think that once this happens, I think that this will be a pretty strong force in dealing with, the government, and also I think they'll be the ones to evolve the Indian culture.
I know the Indian culture throughout the United States has had kind of a resurgence right now. People are taking, like you said, people are taking more pride in their heritage. They're becoming aware of the fact that they have a lot to offer. And, for instance, Native Americans all over are becoming a political force that they weren't before, but now they are. And this means the Seminole tribe, too, because you all have a political side, too, which you have an elected chief, and you do, go through a political process yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that in the future the Seminoles will be able to deal better with Western culture the Anglo side of what's going on around here because of a new awareness of this, a new...
I think there will be. I think that this is an overall scope, I guess, of what I think the Indian people see, and this is what I'm feeling and what I'm seeing, is that America, I'm talking about everybody within it, it's like it has reached this point. I think right now we are threatening, I guess, on thin water now with other countries because of what we're doing. And I think this Indian culture that eventually will get developed is going to be an addition to that peak. It's going to start people looking a little bit harder into themselves, or inspiring more, I guess, more people into doing a little bit more or refining a little bit more better. I think anytime you get any type of refinement, I think, involved, you get works of, great art and music. I think America is overdue. So I'm hoping that this evolution will get to that point where it will spread, I think, to this country a little bit. I think filter in is the word, to inspire other people. Because another thing that I went out to Big Cypress to do was to get away and start doing some artwork. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing traditional art or doing Indian people, I want to get, I guess, a little bit more background from the people. And then the Culture Heritage Program just kept going. This then all of a sudden it changed. The talents that I had in art evolved into what I'm doing now, is working with the people and trying to understand them a little bit more, because they've inspired me, I think, where I can get off the canvas, where I can get off the canvas and work directly with the people, being involved in those areas, developing, I guess, new techniques or new material to use in the process of this change. And I think this is what it's all about. I think if I did it on canvas, it would be something that's separate. It would be my feelings towards that canvas, and that would be it. But now my feelings towards my people is something different, totally different, because I'm getting a feedback that the whole process is affecting them, and they see more of what they want to do but can't do. And then all of a sudden I become the instrument. And this is what has happened, really.
You say canvas. Are you a painter?
Yes, I have a large canvas, about 8 foot by 10 foot canvas that I took out there, and I've been working on it very slowly because I hardly ever have time. But one of the first things I did was to go out there and do some painting, and it just happened that I just got caught up in this and just kind of detoured right now. But still, I get back into it eventually.
Uh-huh. Well, what are those kinds of traditional arts that the Seminoles do that you think are important? I know you mentioned one is canoe building. Mm-hmm. What are the other things that are important to keep alive?
I think another thing is that the fabrics, the design work. The story behind that is that this lady was going to go to a Green Cornet, mm-hmm. and I think this is a time they get married, a time to show off their wealth, a time of just appreciating everybody's, you know, being there. And in your presence meant that, you know, you thought highly of yourself. And when you went, you got all dressed up to go. This lady was going to go, but she didn't have enough material. So she just went ahead and added additional material, combining different colors together, and just went. And when she did, she started that evolution again where everybody appreciated what they saw, and it just kept going, getting better and better. And I think from the very beginning, I guess in the late 50s, you could see the design work, the patchwork, and see the awkwardness or the big shapes, the big clumps of material they put together. And today you look at them now, they're so fine, you know, but anywhere from maybe a half an inch or something, that there's about 15 different colors in it, added to it. And that's a refinement. That's very basic, I guess. That's very raw, this type of refinement, but it's there. And I think that this is what we're talking about here, a refining of the Indian people to give up, to do their ultimate, even though it just might be a design work, but still there's this process. And I think that we're seeing this, and I think that this is one of the things that inspires me to, I think, look a little bit deeper within our people, because there's quite a bit out there.
I can really appreciate the patchwork. I know when we were up in Washington, there was a quilt maker next to Linda who was making the patchwork, and she was just amazed because she was making a patchwork quilt, but big, like you say, big pieces of fabric, yeah. And she was looking at that and going, oh, you know, it's those very tiny, little tiny patches, and just beautiful designs. Each design had a name, mm-hmm. You know, whatever it looked like, a rabbit or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just beautiful. And what other things besides the patchwork?
Another thing is poly bead work. They mm-hmm. do real intricate work in those areas. And those were originally started as a letter to give information or to tell a story on these bead works. Maybe at that time, I don't know, I guess they couldn't get paper mm-hmm. or any other means. So they beaded little rocks or stones with different colors, and maybe certain emblems stood for certain event or a certain happening. And as it went along, it was maybe you get a long beads, maybe about a foot long or something, and it told a story, I guess, within somebody's life, a certain activity that had taken place. We've gotten away from that, and now it's used as an ornament. But I think some ornaments that you get, I've had a lady make a headband for me once, and it came out real nice. And I thought, you know, wow, just the figures, the characters on there, you didn't predict me, but still, I feel like this was my identity because it had eagle feathers on it. Hoping that means something.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And what about dolls, the dolls?
I think it's just like what the little girls have, is just infatuation for having little somebody smaller than they could play with. They couldn't play with a human being because they might drop them and hurt them, so they gave them something else to play with, which was a symbol of the human being. And as time went along, same thing with that process. It started off maybe as a wooden carving of a body, of a human body, and then then they start getting into a point where they saw different material fiber that they could mold this into. And this process took place again. Now you can find them, I think, in gift shops and also any place else. But these are made from palmetto fibers. Everything on them is hands woven or sewn together by hand. Then the last garment that's put on them is the little traditional clothes, you know, the long cape and gown. And these are done by, you know, same type of method of making those patchworks. Mm-hmm. And they're made down, they're broken out into a smaller scale than, and this is what they used to, you know, let the kids play with. But now they find it's a little bit more profitable. They sell it to a gift shop.
Mm-hmm. Do anybody, Does anyone else make those kind of dolls?
There's quite a few people. I think a lot of older people make them. I think anywhere from their 50s on up will make them. I think anybody younger than that are usually working within, I guess, the tribal system or on the outside, so they don't have time to make those things.
Mm-hmm. But it's really a Seminole craft, though. It's not something that anybody else makes besides...
No, it ain't.
I've never seen them anywhere. Somewhere else. What about, I was thinking, you said you're teaching some of the legends. Could you just pick one legend out of all or story out of all of them and just tell us a story for the radio, that something that is important to the culture that you feel is good to pass on?
I guess this is the only thing I have is this one story I heard. It's how certain animals are in certain areas because of these type of methods that have taken place. This story is about a rabbit, and it's like Bugs Bunny. He's really clever and, you know, wiry, and he gets away with a lot of things. The Indians tell stories of a rabbit that's in the same character as that Bugs Bunny. And this character plays a lot of part within our Indian stories. He's a deceiving, he's a lying, he's crafty. I think that when a lot of people are like this, they'll call him Chukfulaji, our rabbit liar, and they're describing what that rabbit is, and if they call you that, you know what they're talking about. So, this story is about how the lions got to Africa.
Is this going to be a long story, because I need to change tapes?
Chukfulaji?
Chukfulaji.
Yeah, you know, that's real.